Fellow and a People and Culture Manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlon. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Tune in tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll be going to Britain for the latest, and we'll also be talking about other red shoes. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Hola, Remy. Hola, Leila. Habla, Ash. Los quiero mucho.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org. The League of Women Voters has online voters' guides, videos, and podcasts to help voters understand the state and local candidates and measures that will be on the ballot this November. Nonpartisan voter information is at lwvpdx.org.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up tonight on the KBOO Evening News, the candidates for Oregon governor clash on the housing crisis.
Representative Drazen walked her Republican colleague off the job and $120 million in funding that could have gone to shelters.
The Speaker of the House prioritized almost everything before she prioritized homelessness.
A Supreme Court challenge for the Clean Water Act after 50 years. And in international news, yet another British leader calls it quits. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 20th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for listening. All evacuation levels are now lifted for the Nakia Creek wildfire, and people can go home in Clark County. That's according to the sheriff's office. The fire had forced hundreds from their homes since Sunday, and it sent particle pollution rates soaring to give Portland and Seattle the worst air to breathe in the world. However, wind and rain are moving in and cleaning it out over the next several days. The fire is now 25% contained. Two of Oregon's candidates for governor, Tina Kotek and Christine Drazen, clashed on the issue of who is responsible for the housing crisis and houselessness in the state during their last KGW Oregonian televised debate.
Representative Drazen walked her Republican colleagues off the job and $120 million in funding that could have gone to shelters, new affordable housing construction, and siting our shelters faster didn't happen. We lost momentum. I will lead where Governor Brown couldn't or wouldn't on this issue, and Representative Drazen's record on this is one of failure.
The assertion that the Speaker of the House, that's had responsibility for this challenge for over a decade, would hand responsibility to the House Republican leader, it's a little bit flattering, but it's really, really, really off base. The reality of the situation is that the Speaker of the House prioritized almost everything before she prioritized homelessness, and the opportunity to address this issue has been on her plate for a very long time. She's failed to lead on this issue, and you can't pass it off to Kate Brown. You certainly can't pass it off to the Republicans. This is the greatest indictment of Tina Kotek's leadership.
I talked to historian Dr. Chris Nichols about the direction of the debate and Oregon's upcoming election. So let's talk about midterm mudslinging that's underway.
Here we go.
Like we've gotten to the point of the campaign where it's my opponents are lying liars coming at each other. Tina said they're lying about her record, not remembering their own records correctly. For example, on the shortage of public defenders last night. I wonder what your thoughts were. What were your impressions? What you thought about the debate and what you saw of it last night?
So I think that we're at that stage, as you said, where the mudslinging begins. Your average American voter really doesn't pay attention to the last month, and most polling suggests that they really don't pay attention to the last few weeks. So we're in that unique window when people do care. And that heightens the tensions, the stakes, and sometimes the like vituperative assaults on people. So I thought it was a pretty contentious debate. There are a lot of allegations of lying, for instance, which is the sort of big, difficult word in politics that you tend not to accuse your opponents of directly to their face. It's often done in ads. So, you know, one takeaway there, I think, was that they all agreed on a few issues like homelessness, that that's a major problem in the state. There was sort of a rough consensus, although I think it's belied by the voting records and policy records, but a rough consensus on questions of climate change or emissions. There was also a consensus, interestingly, that the schools had been closed in the state for too long. Who to villainize for that was up in the air. What any of them would do in the future if schools might need to be closed, I thought also was deliberately vague by virtually everyone.
Yeah, Kotek and Drazen both accusing each other of throwing our kids under the bus. They both use that phrase at each other, and they're still doing it on Twitter today. They're tweeting it out about, she's throwing our kids. No, she's throwing our kids under the bus. And who is that pitch aimed at? Voters with school-age kids must be really important in this election.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's probably especially, I think the demographics would suggest, aimed at mothers, right? Or a female demographic of people who have been really alarmed and troubled by pandemic-related childcare issues and school issues. You know, I think one thing that stands out to me as someone who's studied the 1918 flu pandemic and talked a lot about the pandemic over the last few years is that they kept talking about schools being closed, but ask any teacher and they felt like schools were wide open. They were working incredibly hard for Zoom classes and instruction and all kinds of things. And ask any student, and though a lot of them weren't in schools technically, a lot of them felt like they had plenty of school. And we know there's learning loss, there are all kinds of issues that have happened. But, you know, that kids were thrown under the bus seems like high politics. And the reality is a lot of people were trying to serve kids well, and it was incredibly hard to do so. I think that's worth mentioning. And so I thought there were a few intonations in the debate, but they couldn't get into many of the details where they could have been, you know, championing teachers more. Thinking more about working parents and how hard this has been. I mean, none of them said that my solution to this, among other things, is better, healthier, and cheaper childcare, for instance. You know, they did talk about summer school programs and they touched on a few other things. So anyway, I think that that's a piece of this puzzle is to not politicize and polarize, but actually think about what it has meant to hold school remotely for so long and what some of the fractures and fissures in society have been revealed because we had so much childcare going on and because we worked our teachers and our schools so hard.
No doubt about that. Yeah, props to all of you teachers for sure. We know what you went through. As far as the word spoiler coming up with Johnson, she's getting a little bit of heat on that and did seem to be a bit heated in her response to it, trying to turn that around and say that Kotek is the spoiler of the whole state. Do you think she's getting pressure to drop out?
Oh, I think she's getting a lot of pressure to drop out. I think it's mounting and mounting. It was a really interesting turn there when they were talking about that. You can see that in the reporting coverage too. So she says that Kotek has taken the Democratic Party too far left and thus spoiled it somehow. And Drazen said, hey, keep me out of this. I want to work for all Oregonians, which is a nice, you know, rhetorical flourish. You guys are just talking about the future of the Democratic Party, you know. But Kotek's take on that was, you know, we don't need to elect Republican in the state whose views are out of touch with the majority of Oregonians, in fact, what we need to do is not have this spoiled by someone who's mostly a Democrat, but it doesn't like the direction of the party by and large, and has had some pretty big benefactors and has a long career and a lot of allies to draw on to stay in the race. So that's my analysis overlaid over Kotek's critique. It's a really amazing thing. I mean, you've interviewed all the candidates and you know this as well as I do. She's skirted this line, Johnson has skirted this line all candidacy. Are you a spoiler? And she's begun to sort of, though she's saying she's not, she also is recognizing that she is functionally one.
And the trying to give a label, trying to blame Kotek for everything, basically, calling her Tent City Tina, seems almost Trumpian, you know, coming up with a name, you know, a nickname that's derogatory toward your opponent.
Yeah, she certainly has a populist sort of streak, for sure. And that works with her base, right? So she's not wrong there, but it did seem that way. You know, and I think, you know, it's interesting on the homelessness set of issues and making Tina Kotek seem vilifying her. It's such an intractable problem in so many ways. You know, they blithely suggest that there are clear solutions like larger camping facilities and locations that more public service can access. That's all well and good, but there's a whole lot of other sets of problems there. One of the things that was really interesting, I think, to drill down on in the debate was Drazen was arguing that ultimately it should not be the choice of citizens to live homeless and that the state had to take up that authority. But at the same time, Drazen was making arguments about keeping the government off the back of individuals and letting them make their own decisions. And I think you really can't have it both ways. If individuals, for whatever reason, substance abuse problems, flawed choices, psychological, mental illness, and other problems, if for whatever reasons, if they're choosing or winding up homeless, the government rounding up those individuals very much flies in the face of a Republican talking point that individuals should have a choice to choose all kinds of things like vaccination, like schools, right? Gun rights. There's a whole wide range of things. So it is fascinating to see cast in sharp relief on the homelessness issue, which is the most important one by most polls for Oregonians, that Drazen wants to have it both ways. Whereas Kotek is being castigated by Johnson as Tent City Tina, has been trying to abide by the fact that there are individuals who have, for a variety of social reasons and individual reasons, either chosen or continue to live in homelessness and figure out, you know, public service kinds of ways to help them with treatment and other things. And I'm not suggesting that she's got the right answers necessarily there, but it was a real contrast between the two philosophies because of the contradictions that are inherent in that. And I didn't think Johnson exactly was that persuasive. If anything, she seemed to be pretty close to Drazen on that set of issues as well. So she wasn't, you know, if you think about her populist elements, the people supporting her who want to also have individual choice in so many other walks of their lives, I wouldn't think that rounding up homeless individuals would fit well with that set of beliefs or philosophies.
Yeah, and civil liberties and all of that too.
Yeah.
You know, in a tight race like this, is it pretty normal stuff though to have, you know, to be calling each other liars and you're throwing the kids under the bus? That kind of strong language by Trumpian standards is probably mild, but based on what you saw and experience of Oregon's elections, is this effective and is it normal?
I think it's pretty normal. You know, the Buehler campaign, he had tried to be a little bit more above board in his rhetoric through some of the last campaign. And then when it came, push came to shove in the last month or so, at least the way that I recollect it, you saw more of a vituperative language coming out as they tried to narrow the gap with Brown. So, you know, I think this is consistent with the pattern. I also think this is really consistent with this moment. This is a three-way race with three viable, as we've talked about before, skilled, experienced female politicians. They all know their stuff. They know this is the time to make that case, to close the case with the electorate. Part of that is damaging your opponents. I mean, you know, it's political science 101 of elections is going negative, going hard works. It doesn't mean that it's right. It doesn't mean that it's a good thing for democracy. In fact, we're digging deep on that. But, you know, I think this fits with it, with past patterns. And it also defies like simplistic gender stereotypes that women would somehow be better about this, right? No, these are all experienced politicians trying to win.
That was my talk with Dr. Chris Nichols, a history professor with The Ohio State University. He previously was at Oregon State University for 10 years. The issue of abortion rights appears to be lighting a fire under women voters. As Mary Sherman reports, women are registering to vote in higher numbers in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn the federal right to an abortion.
In this election cycle, a new poll indicates women's voices matter more than ever. Polling in Ohio and eight other battleground states by Lake Research Partners found that abortion and equal rights are top drivers for women who plan to vote. Kathy Spiller is executive editor of Ms. Magazine, which released the poll along with Feminist Majority Foundation. She says it found 41% of young women voters are feeling angry or worried about the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe versus Wade.
Overturning abortion rights has lit a fire under women in the battleground states, especially young women. And in fact, women who are for abortion rights are far more energized in this election around this issue than those who oppose abortion.
Spiller says this refutes past trends of abortion opponents being more motivated by the issue. While Ohio does not track voter registrations by gender, a New York Times report found the percentage of newly registered female Ohio voters rose following the Dobbs decision from 47% to 54%. Spiller says the polling also reveals that young women voters understand they don't have the equal rights guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution.
They are saying that it's more important than ever now that the Equal Rights Amendment be added to the Constitution to guarantee there can't be discrimination on the basis of sex. Three quarters of all women likely voters in the battleground states make that connection.
And Spiller notes because women account for half of voters, the issues they care about could impact the outcome of elections and which party has the majority in Congress.
This election is much more than about inflation or crime or any of the other issues that we keep hearing about. Women's lives, our rights, access to abortion and birth control is top of mind for women voters in these battleground states.
55% of young women voters ranked abortion and women's rights the most important issues determining their vote in the elections. Just one-third of young women voters ranked inflation and rising prices as their top issues motivating their vote, a difference of 22 points. And only 9% ranked climate change and 5% for education debt. I'm Mary Sherman.
Supporters of legalizing marijuana in state where it is not legal say it removes barriers that stem from an arrest for simple pot possession, like getting jobs and finding a place to live. As Mike Moen reports, recreational marijuana is making another appearance on the ballot in South Dakota.
Just as in 2020, voters across South Dakota will have a chance in November to decide whether the state should legalize possession of small amounts of marijuana for adults. In a highly publicized process, a similar ballot question was approved in South Dakota 2 years ago, but it was ultimately rejected by the state Supreme Court over technical issues. This time, supporters left out the provisions dealing with licensing and taxation. Matthew Schweik, who manages the Yes on 27 campaign, says while it isn't the broader proposal, they're still proud of the question they put forward.
Measure 27 is good public policy. It eliminates cannabis arrests for adults. It means that police can focus on serious crime.
If approved, people 21 and older would be allowed to possess or distribute up to 1 ounce of marijuana and could own up to 3 plants. And there would be civil penalties for violators. Citing social ills, Governor Kristi Noem helped lead the legal challenge to the 2020 outcome. This year, the Coalition Protecting South Dakota Kids says legalization would harm communities. Opponents also contend efforts to pass these measures rely on out-of-state funding. But Schweik argues the initial approval in 2020 showed that a majority of South Dakotans support the idea. And if it clears the hurdle again, he thinks policymakers should accept the result.
It means that we can restore the will of the people and uphold South Dakota's heritage. South Dakota created the initiative process, and that's an idea that spread to over half of the states in the country.
19 states and the District of Columbia allow some form of recreational marijuana. This fall, a handful of others, including neighboring North Dakota, also have legalization questions on the ballot. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
British Prime Minister Liz Truss resigned today. She served in office for only 45 days, the shortest term ever in that office. The dramatic development came days after Truss fired her Treasury head, after the economic package they revealed triggered an economic and political crisis. It was also hastened by the resignation yesterday of Home Secretary Suella Braverman, who quit after sending an official document from her personal email account. She used her resignation letter to attack Truss, saying she was concerned about the direction of the government. Truss's is the third resignation by a conservative prime minister in 3 years. A growing number of lawmakers had called for Truss to resign after her economic plan led to weeks of turmoil. The plan led to a political crisis that included the replacement of Truss's Treasury chief, multiple policy 180s, and a general breakdown of discipline in the governing Conservative Party. Yesterday, she had vowed to stay in power, calling herself a fighter. But Truss quit after meeting with Graham Brady, a senior conservative lawmaker who oversees leadership challenges. Brady's job was to decide whether or not the prime minister still had the support of Tory members of parliament, and she did not. Other legislators said, quote, "It's time for the prime minister to go. She isn't up to the job, sadly, and it's not responsible for the party to allow her to remain in power." A vote yesterday on fracking turned ugly. Truss wanted to resume that practice despite opposition from many conservatives. A call for a fracking ban was easily defeated, but there were angry demonstrations in the House of Commons. An editorial in the Daily Mail carried the headline, quote, "The wheels have come off the Tory clown car," end of quote. It's not clear who the Conservative Party wants as a replacement. Whoever takes the job will be the country's third prime minister this year alone. A national election does not have to be held until 2024. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's the end of summer show on Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, The Lost Children of Turtle Island on EcoJustice Radio. Tonight's weather, a few clouds, areas of smoke reducing visibility at times, low down to 46. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with periods of rain, a high of 53. Today in history, political turmoil on this date in 1947. Historian Dr. Chris Nichols shares his insight on that. On this date in 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee opened hearings into alleged communist influence and infiltration in the U.S. motion picture industry. And of course, that was what some called the Red Scare.
Yeah, hugely significant in the early Cold War was this series of moves of McCarthyism, so-called Red Scare, right? This is slightly preceding McCarthyism in the moment, but building up to it. So the Hollywood blacklists are one result of those 9 days of hearings in 1947 by HUAC, the House Un-American Affairs Committee. The House Un-American Affairs and sort of had some precursor sorts of committees. One of them comes out of World War I, actually, and a Red Scare following that. A lot of widespread deportations of immigrants, of people who are seen as radicals, of political radicals, and that sort of thing. And he has a few other committees during the 30s that did this sort of stuff. But it's right at the end of World War II, 1945, that this becomes a standing committee, so a regular old committee in the House. And they push forward with a series of these high-profile hearings, of which, you know, the listeners and folks thinking about this undoubtedly know the culmination, which is the series of hearings that has Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers and these famous figures within government. And were they communists? You know, 1947 is the Hollywood folks. There's a whole lot of communists in Hollywood. They're infiltrating our brains and minds, was the kind of logic of that moment in that Red Scare. And then you get up to the, you know, have you no decency moment in 1954 with McCarthy and the Army McCarthy hearings. This is a signature moment in American democracy if you think about the ways that hearings can proceed. We've just had the January 6th hearings, right? We're thinking about, you know, this cataclysmic event that happened in American democracy. How should you publicize that? Who should come in? Who should testify? How should that be reported? And then, you know, I think the HUAC hearings, you could argue, started from with a genuine concern that there were infiltrators in U.S. government, and then they rapidly expand out. And this moment, this date in history, 1947, is a great example. You know, should Congress be investigating Hollywood for the political leanings that members of Hollywood may have had, including many decades before? Did they vote for a socialist in the 1912 election? Questions like that. I mean, that does not seem very pertinent to what's happening in the early Cold War, or whether or not they should be allowed to continue with their jobs in Hollywood, which of course in and of itself probably shouldn't be something that the House of Representatives should be deciding.
And that was Dr. Chris Nichols, a historian with The Ohio State University. On the Clean Water Act's 50th anniversary, the issue is returning to the Supreme Court. As Suzanne Potter reports, though the laws had many successes, the court could soon limit the waters it protects.
The Clean Water Act turns 50 years old this week, but parts of it are currently under attack in a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. The case could remove protections from some streams and wetlands, which would then make it easier and cheaper to pollute or even eliminate those waterways. Shantae Coleman, with the National Wildlife Federation, says the law was partially motivated by the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill.
And many California cities, even large ones, had very limited sewage treatment. There weren't any federal controls on industrial pollution or oil spills, so many cities dumped largely untreated sewage into the Pacific Ocean or its coastal bays, and the federal government itself dumped 50,000 barrels of radioactive waste into the Pacific Ocean.
California has strict rules to protect water, but a new report from the National Wildlife Federation says the case, Sackett versus EPA, could allow factories, hog farms, and wastewater plants to pollute waters in other states that lack strong water quality protections. The report highlights the success in turning Monterey Bay from an ecological disaster caused by pollution and overfishing into a healthy ecosystem and thriving tourist destination, and credits the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Coleman says few laws have ever had such a massive impact.
The Clean Water Act keeps 700 billion pounds of pollutants out of our waters annually and has slowed the rate of decline of wetland loss and doubled the number of waters that are safe for fishing and swimming.
The report also calls on Congress to do more to address agricultural runoff, which is the leading reason bodies of water across the U.S. do not meet water quality standards. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Oil reserves are released before the midterm elections. Electric vehicle battery production gets grant funding, and a federal judge says a document shows former President Trump knew voter fraud allegations were false. With more in the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
We need additional federal funding to help, you know, the most vulnerable families in our country pay these high bills until either supply increases, prices come down.
With just a few weeks until the midterm elections, President Biden announced his plans to address oil and energy prices, which have remained steadily higher than average despite crude oil prices dropping on international markets. Biden stood by his decision to release 15 million barrels of oil from the country's strategic petroleum reserve to help increase supply and drive prices down, and says it falls in line with his plan to transition to cleaner energy. Republicans criticized the move, saying it was politically motivated.
The problem is these guys are asleep. I don't know where they've been. The price at the pump should reflect what the price of a barrel of oil costs.
Biden also announced $2.8 billion in grant funding, which will go to 20 companies across the country to aid in commercial-level battery production for use in electric vehicles. Biden says the action will help battle the economic hardship the country's facing while simultaneously contributing to fight climate change. A federal judge showed former President Trump signed a document under oath within a Georgia lawsuit acknowledging the information was true and decided to proceed with voter fraud allegations anyway, despite Trump's own lawyers telling him it was false.
Vote on election day in person, because it's really much harder for them to cheat.
The revelation comes amid the legal battle between conservative lawyer John Eastman and the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th assault, which was able to obtain email subpoenaed from Eastman. In Florida Tuesday, Republican Senator Marco Rubio went head-to-head in a debate with Democratic Representative Val Demings. The two candidates debated a wide range of issues ranging from guns, natural disasters, and the economy. One of the night's most heated exchanges surrounded abortion.
And that's why every law that's out there has exceptions, including the one that she's attacking me on, has exceptions. Every law I've ever passed has exceptions. We're never going to get a vote on a law that doesn't have exceptions, because that's what the majority of the American people are, and I respect and understand that.
Penny Nance, CEO of the group Concerned Women for America, a conservative and evangelical nonprofit organization, says she hopes women get out to vote in the upcoming midterms and believes women are interested in issues beyond just abortion.
We're not single-issue voters. If you look at polling, when you talk to women about what their concerns are, abortion's at the bottom. At the top right now is inflation and crime.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A Minnesota education leader apologizes for a too diverse question. Astronaut man answers native media questions during a live International Space Station event. And the UK starts a repatriation efforts for a museum. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
The vice chair of the board that oversees the University of Minnesota system apologized after asking if whether one of the higher education institutions has become too diverse. Michigan Public Radio reports Steve Swigum posed the question at a Board of Regents meeting. He was referring to the U of M Morris campus that once housed an Indian boarding school. Qualified Native students can attend the college tuition-free. Native students are by far the largest minority group enrolled. During the meeting, Swigum said he'd gotten letters from friends whose children chose different schools because, in his words, they didn't feel comfortable there. White students make up about 54% of the college population. That number is down slightly from 5 years ago. Almost a third of the total enrolled students identify as Native. Astronaut Nicole Mann says she hopes to be an inspiration as the first Native woman to fly into space. Mann, who is Wailaki from the Round Valley Indian tribes, fielded questions from Native media outlets and Native children while aboard the International Space Station on Wednesday. Mann launched on October 5th, serving as mission commander on NASA's SpaceX Crew 5 mission, aboard the Dragon-style aircraft named Endurance. Associated Press aerospace writer Marsha Dunn asked Mann questions submitted from various Native media outlets and tribal schools. The questions covered everything from her view of Earth to how tribal wisdom, traditions, and family advice played a role in her career. She said her accomplishment as the first Native woman in space is part of a larger legacy of Native people helping advance the aerospace industry.
It makes me feel very proud. It makes me proud to be able to follow in the footsteps of those trailblazers, of those other Native Americans and Native American women that have been involved in aerospace industry and in engineering. There is a long line of people that broke down barriers throughout the years to create these opportunities, and I feel grateful to be able to participate and represent on board the International Space Station, and I really hope to continue that inspiration to other young children around the world.
NASA says the crew's mission will last 5 months and includes hundreds of scientific experiments. The whole interview can be viewed on NASA's YouTube channel. Native leaders in Texas are fighting renewed calls to build two liquefied natural gas export terminals on sacred tribal land. The Texas Tribune reports Juan Mancias, chair of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe, has been fighting LNG on a global scale for the last year and has had many victories in that battle. But the war in Ukraine is driving demand for LNG and has reinvigorated the search for funding to build a gas pipeline and two new terminals on a site in the Rio Grande River Delta on the Gulf Coast. The area is integral to the tribe's creation beliefs, where they say the first woman was born. The terminals could be massive structures that liquefy natural gas export to global markets. The Sierra Club says they would produce as much carbon as more than 40 million cars a year. Local politicians expressed support for the terminals, including U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, because of the potential economic benefit they could bring to the area. The University of Kansas issued an apology and restarted repatriation efforts after Native American ancestors were found as part of the university's museum collection. The university said a recent redisclosure identified sacred objects, funerary items, and more, along with the culturally unidentified individual remains. The school said they had already tried to repatriate the items, but never completed the process. KU says it will establish a Native Advisory Committee and consult directly with tribal nations and provide new facilities for the Indigenous Studies Program and support for students, staff, and faculty. For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montano.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 20th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Saylor.